This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. I don't have to remind you that it's a presidential election year. We'll be doing plenty of shows on Indiana's role in shaping national politics leading up to the May primary and the November election, but we'll also be looking back at data that shows how voting demographics have evolved over the years. And for today's topic, we're looking at the last 100 years since women were given the right to vote. Notre Dame political science professor Christina Walbrecht and Kevin Corder of Western Michigan University co-wrote the new book, A Century of Votes for Women. And they join us now via Skype. Christina, welcome.
Thank you.
And Kevin, thanks for coming on.
Hi, thanks.
And just so you know, today's show is pre-recorded, so we can't take questions or comments for our panel, but there is a lot to talk about, so let's get to it. Christina Walbrecht, I imagine the timing of this book, this year being the centennial anniversary of women's suffrage, as well as a presidential election year, is a good part of the reason why you decided to do it. But what are some other reasons for getting this book together?
So that's a great question. You're absolutely right. So Kevin and I had spent a long time doing a project on women voters in the 20s and the 30s, right after the 19th Amendment was ratified. You would think 100 years later, we knew what happened after that. But the truth is we don't. Men and women don't put pink and blue ballots into ballot boxes. And we really don't have good public opinion polls or surveys from that period, which is, of course, how we know how different groups of voters vote today. So that was a really labor-intensive project that came out in 2016. And we suddenly sort of looked ahead and thought, you know, we finally got a pretty good answer for the 20s and 30s. There's some new data we can look at for the 30s and 40s. And then in the 50s, there's some really good surveys. And we realized there's really not one place where you can sort of hear the story of how women have used their right to vote for the last 100 years. And we absolutely thought going into this centennial year, women are running for president, the sort of blue wave in 2018, that this would be a really good time to sort of put that out there for folks who want to understand our current politics as well.
Okay, so what did you then find about the 20s and 30s? You said there wasn't a lot there, but you found something. This came out in 2016?
It did. So there's a lot of conventional wisdom about how women voted in the 20s and 30s. As early as 1923 and 1924, we found lots of newspaper headlines saying women's suffrage is a failure. And what they meant was that women didn't turn out to vote, and when they did, they vote like their husbands basically tell them to. And one of the things we were able to show in that book is, well, it is true that women's turnout lagged behind men's, and women would not be more likely to vote than men until 1980. There was a lot of variation in that, and places that were really competitive and didn't have a lot of electoral barriers like poll taxes, women's turnout was pretty impressive right from the beginning. Places where there were barriers, again, literacy tests, those sorts of things, women's turnout was a lot lower. In terms of voting like their husbands, it is the case that women entered the electorate and, for the most part, voted for the same parties and candidates as did men. I like to say to my own students, I also vote like my husband votes, and I will let you make your own assumptions about causality and who's telling who what. And we don't have a lot of evidence to really say definitely, you know, if you ask women, they all said, well, I did whatever, you know, my husband said. One of the inspirations for this new book was it made sense in the 20s and 30s. We don't have a lot of good data. Journalists, scholars are going what they have, that there would be sort of this mismatch between sort of accepted conventional wisdom about women voters and what we actually know about women voters. But the truth is, one of the things we argue in this most recent book is that continues. Even today, with so many surveys and so many tools at our disposal, there's a real mismatch between how we talk about women voters in popular discourse and what women actually do.
It is surreal to hear a quote like that. Women's suffrage is a failure from 1923, 1924, thereabouts.
Right.
It is surreal to hear something like that today.
Can I jump in on that, too?
Sure. Go ahead.
One of the things that we found, too, was that there was this expectation that women were really going to disrupt the electorate, that it was going to be crazy. There was going to be all kinds of new parties that came in, and there was going to be all kinds of, the two-party monopoly was going to go away. We found just the opposite. right? The entry of women to the electorate stabilized the electorate. Women were less likely to support third parties, more loyal to the traditional parties. So some of the expectations for disruption weren't realized. And that's one of the reasons people said, well, it just didn't matter when we expanded the suffrage because we still have the same two parties monopolizing electoral competition.
Kevin Corder, how long have you and Professor Walbrecht been teaming up on projects like this?
Well, we started the first, we got a grant in 1998 to start working on the first book. And we worked on that together for you know, 15 to 18 years before we brought it to publication. So we've been working together, what does that make it, more than 20 years on these projects.
All right. Well, let's go back again to sort of the beginning, to sort of right after the women got the vote. Was the turnout strong right off the bat? Obviously, it was a big public, it was a big news story. I mean, it was a big deal, the 19th Amendment. But was the turnout pretty good? Did a lot of women vote the first chance they got? Professor Walbrecht, you can answer that one.
I was going to let Kevin, you go ahead.
Kevin, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, as Christina said, in some places the turnout was remarkably high, approaching 50%. Places like Kentucky, which was a real hotbed of competition and had pretty lax electoral rules. But in other places, it was abysmally low, 10, 15%. So it really varied across states, but women lagged men by a lot for reasons that are not surprising. I mean, the parties weren't experienced mobilizing women. Unions and other kind of male-dominated institutions that had gauged people into politics didn't really have an attachment to women. So it took a steep learning curve for the mobilizing institutions to bring women into the electorate. So in an unsurprising way, women didn't show up to vote in large numbers right away.
We are talking to Notre Dame political science professor Christina Walbrecht and Kevin Corder of Western Michigan University, who co-wrote the book A Century of Votes for Women. And Professor Walbrecht, is there sufficient data to show exactly how women have voted in the entirety of the last 100 years?
There are different forms of information or data available to us depending on what you're looking at. And so for the 20s and 30s, we don't have individual level data. We don't have the kind of surveys that really form the backbone of what we understand about voting today. What Kevin and I's earlier research was able to do is give us some estimates at the state level. So we were able to say, this is our very best guess, is the percentage of women who voted Democratic in Connecticut, the percentage of women who voted Republican in Virginia, those sorts of things. And we have that data from 1920 through 1936, so the first five presidential elections. George Gallup gets going as the innovator of survey research in the 1930s, and some great work has been done recently to sort of recover lots of that data. So we start to have that data in the 30s and the 40s. By 1948, scholars had started what would become known as the American National Election Study, which is a massive study of voters that's done in each presidential election from 1948 on. And so from the middle of the century until today, we have that really nice, stable data source. If you really want to go technical, we also start having exit polls towards the end of the 20th century. The census starts asking about voter turnout in the 1970s. And there's been just an explosion in the last 20 years. One of the things we try to do in the book is leverage as many different sources as we can to say, what can we be most confident about? What do we know from whatever data, whatever's the best data available to us during that period?
I want to talk more about these good surveys, the good survey data that came through in the 50s. Is that at all related to this sort of new attention in the late 40s?
Well, part of this is just sort of innovations that let survey research happen with other sorts of explosions of behavioral research in the period immediately after the Second World War. Gallup was a great salesperson, so not only did he innovate these surveys, but he wrote weekly columns that were available to newspapers all over the country and sort of collaborated in those ways. It might be interesting for folks to know that the American National Election Studies actually happened because folks at the University of Michigan had already created a consumer confidence index that you already hear. Those are based on surveys, very often surveys. And they just for fun added questions about voting onto that survey in the late 1940s. One thing to say, though, is that those views that women's suffrage is a failure, and particularly that women vote like their husbands, were really consequential. So we have a quote in the book from George Gallup who says, how will women vote exactly as they were told the night before? So he also believed that women would just vote as their husbands told them. And since his interest was trying to understand how do people decide how they're going to vote, he purposely undersampled women because, as that quote suggests, there really wasn't anything to explain. And if you really wanted to know what was moving the vote, you needed to focus on men.
So this was a long sort of adjustment for the United States of America. Professor Corder, I mean, it is hard for us to imagine a world where women aren't allowed to vote. It's only been 100 years, but I guess what were some of the reasons going way back to just before women's suffrage? What were some of the quote unquote reasons given at the time against women's suffrage?
Well, I guess the two main reasons I would point to was, one, there was this idea that women were kind of incapable of forming independent political judgments, prone to hysteria, somewhat irrational, maybe uninformed. They just didn't have the capacity to evaluate the candidates with the same sophistication as men. So that was one important reason why there was a reservation to extend the suffrage to women. The other one is that politics was perceived as masculine. You know, voting used to happen in bars, and it was rough and tumble, and the language was crude, and it was the idea that women would be kind of spoiled or tainted if they participated in this process. So it's kind of a way to protect women and their status. We needed to keep them out of the voting booth. And so those two interacted in a very powerful way to say that politics is just man's business.
We're taking a look at the new book, A Century of Votes for Women, with its authors, Notre Dame Professor of Political Science Christina Walbrecht and Western Michigan University's J. Kevin Corder. When we come back, we'll look at how women voted in 2016 compared to men. Some of the results may surprise you, and how women's involvement in politics has changed. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with two political science professors, Christina Walbrecht of Notre Dame and Kevin Corder of Western Michigan University. They're co-authors of the new book, A Century of Votes for Women, a look at data from the last 100 years since the 19th Amendment was ratified. We just talked about reasons, quote unquote, reasons why women's suffrage. Critics' reasons for why women's suffrage shouldn't happen, I guess, just before the 19th Amendment. Kevin, you had said that a couple of those reasons, the two main ones that critics of women's suffrage gave, were that women were sort of incapable of engaging in politics in a sort of meaningful way, and that politics at that time was perceived as sort of a masculine endeavor. Am I summarizing it well enough?
Yep.
And Professor Walbrecht, as I understand it, the data that we've gotten as far as participation in the last 30 years, and again, it is surreal to imagine a world where women aren't allowed to vote. And it seems like we've got really good data as far as opinions and survey data just from the last 30 years. Am I correct about that?
Yeah. I would say the data is pretty good starting in 1952. It gets better in the 70s. It gets better later. We're facing new challenges with survey research, of course, today with cell phones. And I always tell people my grandmother would have answered any question someone called her to ask, but that's not really the norm anymore. So there are definitely challenges.
Now, when we're talking about survey data, though, what exactly are we talking about? How has that evolved?
There's been a lot of technical progress in how surveys are done. There's also been a proliferation of survey research firms. So there's just a whole lot more data from a whole lot of people that you can look at to kind of triangulate and figure out what works. But there's been some survey research firms do kind of a regular post-election survey. We use the Pew survey. The exit polls and their both improvements and recent challenges have been a really rich source of data for how how people actually voted. So just the number and variety and technical sophistication of polls has improved over time.
So are we talking like specifically, I guess, about like opinion polling with sort of direct questions about the issues of the day? Or are we talking more broadly as far as the data that you have?
Well, the data that we rely on is mostly vote choice. In the book, is mostly about how you voted for president. So we draw in some opinion data from a couple of sources, but we are mostly interested in did you turn out and who did you vote for president. We draw in on other places where we talk. We use party identification data, which is mainly from these American National Election Studies. But the broader there is a lot of broader public opinion data. We don't exploit that much in our work.
Christina Wahlbrecht, is there any validity to the assumptions that people make about women voters? They tend to, I guess the assumptions are that they tend to vote more progressively than men, or that they care about issues affecting children, or that are they a demographic with really any kind of solidarity on particular issues or candidates that we can nail down?
So one of the main themes of the book is this idea that women are not a voting bloc. They don't overwhelmingly vote one way or the other. It is the case that since at least 1980 and possibly a little earlier, women on average are more likely to vote for the Democratic Party than are men. It's certainly been the case, however, as the so-called gender gap has become sort of a perennial topic for elections and how are women going to vote, et cetera, that saying that women are more likely to vote for Democrats makes it sound like most women are Democrats, and that's actually not particularly accurate. So we know, for example, that African-American women are overwhelmingly supportive of the Democratic Party, more than 90% of them. For white women, on the other hand, it's more like 52 to 54% vote Republican in most elections. And so they are less likely to vote Republican, that is white women, than are white men. So it is true that they're more Democratic compared to white men. But that's not the same as saying a majority of them vote for the Democratic candidate. The same is true, and I think this is what's important. We see huge gaps in terms of race. We see emerging strong gaps in terms of social class, measures like education and income. So those things divide, you know, men and women, excuse me, different groups of women more than most gaps between women and men. But at the same time, in nearly every category, women of color, white women, women with college educations, women without college educations, et cetera, that small gender gap where whatever the group is, women are slightly more likely to support Democrats than are similar men does persist.
And we saw that played out in a very real way in 2016. I guess we can get into that. I was going to wait to talk about the election of 2016, but it was all over even the night of the election, talking about exit polls and people who answered a certain way. It seemed like non-college educated people. Today we're talking about women, but people turned out for Trump and college educated people turned out for Hillary Clinton. And are you saying that this was the same for women, or was it in fact perhaps even amplified?
So the word I would use is amplified. So you're exactly right that one of the clear narratives to come out of 2016 is this idea that we're seeing an increasing gap in terms of education, and frankly, in a different direction than it has been historically. There's been a lot of talk, especially about sort of the image of the working class white man, who's getting interviewed by the New York Times in a coffee shop in Pennsylvania. But actually, some recent research and here drawing especially from scholars Aaron Cassisi and Tiffany Barnes show that actually the swing to the Republican Party was larger among women without a college degree than it was among men with a college degree. They swing a little bit towards the Republican Party, but women without a college degree go from being more Democratic than are those men without a college degree to being more Republican than are men without a college degree. And that story, I like to say that the journalist should actually be talking to the waitresses at these coffee shops rather than the working class men that they've been focused on.
Interesting. So Can we then, do we know, I guess data from 2016 is probably more comprehensive than from a century ago. Did women, by a slight majority turn out for Donald Trump in 2016?
It depends on which women you're talking about. Among white women, yes. As we were just discussing, among black women or Latino women, no. Majorities of black women and Latino women turned out for Clinton in 2016. But even among white women, the story is complicated. So as we just said, certainly fairly large majorities of women, white women without a college degree, turned out for Donald Trump. Fairly certain that a majority of women, white women with college degrees, turned out for Hillary Clinton.
What about representation in politics? So women are voting, but women are also candidates. How does that look party-wise?
That's been an interesting change over time since the Republicans in Congress, for instance. The number of women in Congress who are Republicans has remained relatively flat over time, while the number of Democratic women candidates and successful women candidates, members of Congress, has gone way up over time. So we used to see, even back in the 1970s, when women started appearing more in Congress, there wasn't a big disparity between Republican women and Democratic women in numbers. But now there's a huge disparity. So if you're in 2016, if you're thinking about, I want to enter into politics and I want to run, if you're a woman, the Democratic Party looks like the party that would be the one where you could be successful in a primary.
Professor Corder, for me, I know you have the data, so you're right and I'm wrong. But for me, it's a little harder for me to believe that. Is that because I live in Indiana? I feel like here I see a lot of women in both parties as well as third parties.
Yeah, it's Congress that I was talking about. So in state legislatures, you may see a more opportunity for female Republican candidates to emerge. But when you look at the congressional delegations, it just looks like the primary is an uphill battle for women candidates moving to be who want to be want to run as Republicans.
Kevin, what about vote? Oh, go ahead.
Point. That sort of stopping points, as Kevin is suggesting, is in fact state legislators. So we know actually that Republican women, state legislators, are less likely to make the jump, either choose to be candidates or successfully choose to be candidates for the U.S. House or a higher level office, whereas Democratic women on average are more likely to do that out of state legislatures and are more likely to be successful.
Let's go back to some more raw data. Kevin, what about turnout? How do women compare to men as far as just showing up?
Well, they're more likely to vote. And we've known that since 1980, that gap emerged and it's persisted. And so that's just a truism of American politics, right, that women are going to turn out to vote. Now, we haven't seen the kind of an underlying story that men are inherently unfit for politics because they can't show up to vote at the same levels as women. And it hasn't, interestingly, the turnout gap hasn't spilled over into other forms of political activism and activity, where in some men and women are equal and in other forms women a little less likely to participate. But we know with confidence that women are more likely to vote in presidential elections than men.
Professor Wolbrecht, that got you going there for a second.
I enjoyed Kevin's framing of that. One of the things we talk about in the book is almost by definition, when you try to understand how women voted, how gender mattered, that's a comparative project. You've got to compare women to the other people that are not women, who we usually refer to as men. And that makes good sense, but I think as we've already discussed, focusing on differences can sometimes obscure what's actually going on in those groups. And so one of the things we talk about is, you know, when that gender gap emerged in 1980, everyone was like, my God, what are women doing? This is, you know, these super liberal women, and this must be feminism, it must be all these other things. When in fact, the early gender gap, lots of scholarship has shown, was much more driven by the changing behavior of men than it was the changing behavior of women. And so we always have to be careful that when we make these comparisons, we're also looking at the underlying behavior, one, and two, that we avoid this idea that sort of male behavior is the norm. And so again, you know, is the fact that men are less likely to turn out than women a sign that sort of women, that men lack political capacity and interest? Well, nobody's really saying that, but they've certainly been saying it about women, even in the 50s and 60s, when the turnout gap was not that big. Women were maybe 8-10 points behind men, and scholars were still saying, well, women don't really think of themselves political. It's not part of their role. And so certainly one of the things we want to come out of this book is sort of check your biases and think about what sorts of assumptions you're making.
Christina Wahlbreck, how about how politicians talk to women? Are there stereotypes that they play into often when they're trying to get women's votes?
So there's, of course, a lot of different strategies that candidates use. We've been interested to see how consistent some of these are across time. So from the time that women entered the electorate in the 1920s still into today, as you already suggested with some of your earlier comments, this idea that motherhood is sort of a prime identity for women, and that shapes their political interests and their political identity in ways that are different than, for example, happens for fathers. And so it's fascinating to see, you know, in the 20s, politicians talking about child labor laws and infant and maternity protection. And by, you know, the 20-teens, we're talking about soccer moms and waitress moms and hockey moms, right? But we're still thinking of women as fundamentally as mothers. And we suggest in the book, as others have, that this is a pretty narrow way to think about women's interests. And to assume that just motherhood or even the prospect of motherhood is the defining factor that pushes women one way or the other is pretty problematic.
Problematic, however, has it been effective either historically or in more recent years? Or do we even have the data to prove that?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about this is we know that there's no issue, no candidate, no set of conditions that drives women to vote as a bloc. So women aren't kind of up for grabs. You can't get an issue and drive women into to vote for you. But politicians and journalists are always searching for that issue or that circumstance. So they adjust their behavior in meaningful ways, right? They advocate for policies that they might not otherwise, thinking they're going to get the women's vote or trying to get the women's vote. So even if women are up for grabs politically, the fact that they can vote and that there might be an interest out there that they would respond to, politicians make meaningful efforts to reach out to women as voters.
Well, let's keep that light on us for a second. Professor Wahlbreck, how have the media portrayed women as a voting bloc in the same way that politicians have?
For the most part, yes. There's lots of good and easy ways to watch politicians talk in one way. It is interesting that the actual term gender gap came from feminist activists, that the term soccer mom came from Bob Dole in 1996. They're sort of working out how they think that they should appeal to women. I really like the point that Kevin was making there at the end. On the one hand, often they've sort of tried to make women one cohesive group, right? And I'll just again pick on soccer moms. The percentage of the female electorate that is married, white, lives in the suburbs, and has children has never been very large, and it's only been declining over time. And so there are costs to that, right? If you think I've got to appeal to soccer moms, you say and do certain things that maybe you would make other policy promises and other outreach if you thought of women as a more diverse group, if you were worried about single moms or widows or women on welfare or professional women, whatever that might be. All of those are, of course, overlapping categories. Kevin also makes the point, which I think is right, is that when we think about what is the impact of women voters, it's hard to point to a lot of elections and say, my God, the outcome is dramatically different because there were women, although that does happen from time to time. But certainly women have changed political conversations. And because they're such a large part of the electorate, because politicians and parties want to reach out to them, certainly we can see and expect, you know, changes in the political agenda, the sort of issues that are getting talked about, et cetera. But women have to be considered an important block for that to happen.
Kevin Corder, I know almost all predictions were blown out of the water in 2016, but with the data that you have and the trends that you've seen, do you have enough to comfortably predict how women, and again, women are not a voting bloc, and I think that's the lesson for the hour, or perhaps maybe subsets of women will vote in this year's presidential election?
Well, I think if we were fooled last time because we thought everything was going to be different. This candidate was different. These circumstances were different. Both candidates were novelties. So things are going to change. We should have just bet that things were going to stay the same. And I'm comfortable with saying that I don't think that the preferences of groups of women or men, college educated, not college educated, lower income, higher income, white, minority, they're going to roughly be the same. So as a baseline, I think you could expect exactly the same thing, a razor thin popular vote margin.
Kevin Corder is a professor of political science at Western Michigan University. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And Christina Walbrecht is a professor of political science at Notre Dame University. And she, along with Kevin, is co-author of the new book, A Century of Votes for Women, American Elections Since Suffrage. Professor Walbrecht, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Up next, he's 102 and finally living the retired life as of last Thursday. But just before he hung it up, I talked to Bob Vollmer, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources surveyor, who recently received national attention for leaving the job that he's had since 1963. I'm Matt Pelzer. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. Matt Pelzer. The Senate impeachment trial kept many of our listeners from hearing one of our best recent interviews, so we're going to re-air it now. Indiana DNR surveyor Bob Vollmer retired at the end of last week at age 102 from the job he's had since 1963. I talked to him about a week and a half before the big day. Mr. Vollmer, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for listening to me.
So what's all this attention been like for you?
Well, I'm wore out for one thing. I appreciate it. I think it's wonderful. And then very often when I get to tell some of my stories, because I've done a lot of things in my life. I've worked hard. I remember I grew up during the Depression. Food was short. A lot of people were starving. People went fishing a lot. You didn't go fishing for a sport. You went fishing to eat so you could eat. You had to watch your pennies.
Well, you made it through the Depression, and then you fought in World War II, and that took you to the South Pacific, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You see, when the war was coming, it was pretty obvious that there was going to be a war. So some of the fellows that we ran around with, we said, well, there's going to be a war. We're going to be in it sooner or later. Let's get ready. So we would go down around Petersburg and those strip mines down there and practice long-distance swimming. And we thought, well, if we get in a troop ship and get sunk, we might have a long swim.
That's some forward thinking.
Well, really, that's what we did. We'd always take a case of beer with us. and those strip mines were pretty deep, 28 foot so. And you'd have to learn how to tread water real good. So say, throw me a cold one. And you didn't want to lose that beer naturally, so you drank the beer while you were treading, and then you went swimming again. You learned how to swim long distances. You didn't ever use the overhand stroke because that'd wear you out. You would use side strokes, and then you learn how to float and rest for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then start swimming again. Actually, this sounds a little ridiculous, but we did it, and it helped save my life one time overseas when I was putting in a communication line between two islands in the South Pacific. And I'll never forget that, but I had to swim about 10 miles.
Oh, my goodness.
The only reason I made it, I had all this practice. I knew how to do it. I knew how to rest. But and there were sharks out there. one guy, there's three of us, one guy didn't make it. When you get out in the ocean and you're swimming, you kind of separate. Well, three of us, we separated when we hit the mainland with one guy and didn't make it. We don't know what happened to him. He might have drowned, or he might, maybe a shark got him. I don't know.
Oh, my goodness.
But I never forget that. My dad told my brother and I, he said, well, I don't like war. We don't believe in war, but if we're going to have it, he said, I want you two boys be the first ones over the top. Of course, my brother, he didn't make it.
Yeah, he didn't make it, did he?
No, but so many guys didn't. God, we lost thousands and thousands of good men.
Well, and as I understand, part of your retirement is going to be to kind of go back there where you lost friends, including
your
brother.
That's right. I want to go back to visit some of the cemeteries, and I just want to look them over, that's all. We built some gun emplacements, and I want to see if they're still there.
Well, your job, it's pretty physical. It seems like the kind of work you've been doing is probably contributed to your longevity. Surveying's a pretty physical job, right?
That's correct. A lot of people ask me how I can live this long. I think about it a lot, but I don't know for sure. I've guessed at a lot of it. I think a lot of it is our diet. My grandma was a great cook. I know one thing, my grandma, she had a big garden, and she raised a lot of red beets. About every other meal, we had red beets.
They get old after a while?
You'd think you'd get tired of them, but you didn't, because they were good.
Yeah.
My grandma said, eat these red beets. That's what makes your blood red. Of course, we know grandma didn't know exactly what she was talking about, but if grandma said that, that's the way it is. But I don't know. I think part of my longevity is because I don't smoke. I never have smoked. I always thought it was stupid. I still think that. But the doctors told me my lungs were real good, and that's one of the reasons I'm still here.
Well, I'm curious how your work has changed. I've seen some pictures of you with some really modern-looking surveying equipment. I just wonder how many times you've had to make big technology adjustments, computers, cell phones. Have there been changes in your job over the decades that you really weren't crazy
Absolutely.
About?
Absolutely. When I started doing this, our surveying habits were much different. You use what we called a chain. It was 100-foot steel tape. Today, everything's electronic measurements, more accurate. One thing that I think helps me, most of my surveying is in the boondocks around state forest and nature preserve places where you have abundance of trees. And you got to remember that these trees are very necessary to our breathing. Our trees discharge pure oxygen. When I'm out working in the trees, I can breathe better. I have noticed this. That's another reason we want to preserve our forest, because without our green trees, we're not going to have much oxygen, I'll tell you that. That's part of the Department of Natural Resources, of course, all the resources that we protect, including our oxygen, of course, we have water. They're all very necessary to our living. And we got to protect these things. And the Department of Natural Resources, they do a wonderful job.
When was the last time you bushwhacked up a hill? That you did a hill climb out in the boonies?
Oh, I guess maybe a year ago. My leg has been giving me problems. I have one my leg, I have a lot of titanium in it. And I think it broke loose or something, but at my age, I'm not going to worry about it, but I can't climb the hills like I used to. Heck, when I was a young punk, I used to go out to California and climb the mountains out in the High Sierras. That was one of my hobbies. I climbed Mount Whitney a couple of times.
Oh, wow.
I, but my legs are starting to fall apart now. I can get around, but not like I used to. Maybe I'm getting too old.
Okay, well, I understand that there were some days that were a little more memorable than others. You're dealing with property lines, which people can get defensive about. Have you ever been threatened on the job?
Absolutely. I've been threatened. I've been shot at. I've had people sick their dogs on me. You bet I have. But I tell you, that bother never did bother me. You learn how to handle that, too. Oh, I can tell you a lot of dog stories where people, one time a guy was encroaching and he built a structure on state property. He had a mean dog. He didn't want anybody to know where the monument was. So he put his doghouse over the monument. Of course, it was hard to find, and you couldn't hardly get near the doghouse or the dog would take you. The only way you could get near the doghouse was to start chainsawing. The dog didn't like that. He'd move a little bit then, but, oh, yeah, we've had a lot of people at, not so much anymore today. People are getting accustomed to knowing that we're going to get them. But we've run across a lot of bad situations before.
Well, I want to hear more about this Al Capone story.
Well, that's a true story now. I got a call to go up at Bass Lake, up in the northern part of the state. And there was a chain link fence up there. It was blocking off the people's access to the lake. And to make the story short, I went up, looked the situation over, and on this chain link fence, there's a lot of signs up there, metal signs, City of Chicago, keep out, City of Chicago. And I thought, what the hell here? This is Indiana, you know. But the people started gathering around and wanted to complain. And I picked out the leader, and he seemed to be the leader. And I talked to him. It's like I just mentioned before, he is a very polite guy. One of the most polite guys I've ever talked to, especially when you had a problem and you ever thought maybe somebody's going to jump down your throat. But this guy was unusually polite.
And he was a gangster.
That's right. I didn't know it until after it was over, but we made a deal. He was easy. All I had to do was be honest. I didn't try to pull his leg. I told it the way it was, as straight as I could be. And you have to be reasonable with these people. And if you are, you're going to get along with them. But anyway, when I got through with him, we made a deal. It was acceptable to the department and also the people up there. And then I found out his name. His name was Tony Esposito. He was Al Capone's lieutenant.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's the truth. And he was very nice. He invited me in the house. We talked about Tommy guns and all that. And he was free to talk about this. And he told me some things that, of course, like I say, he was a gangster. He had his job to do, and I had my job to do. But we got along real fine. And he brought out a jug of whiskey.
There you go. We're talking to Bob Vollmer. He's a Department of Natural Resources surveyor, and he's about to retire at the age of 102. And because you work for the DNR, I mean, some of my favorite places in the state are, of course, state parks, which are under the DNR's jurisdiction. What are some of your favorite places in the state, some of the most beautiful spots?
Some of the most favorable places are along the Ohio River. One of our new parks is down in Charlestown. And that's along the Ohio River, some of the big bluffs up. My God, it's a beautiful place. And not too many people know about it yet. But of course, the dunes is a wonderful place. I like the dunes real well. There's so many parks that are, they're all great. Down at Spring Mill, it's so unique. They have those caves of blind fish, and And I particularly like that because I have a relative that worked on blind fish a long time ago. He went to Germany, studied a little bit. His name is Twitty, Dr. Victor Twitty. And he lived in Alfordsville. And if you look at him on the website, it's Alfordsville. It's a town near, it's near Ligoti. Because then you said, well, then where's Ligoti? But Dr. Twitty, he's a distant relative of mine. And he did a lot of work on the blind fish. And I guess just being around Spring Mill State Park where they have all the blind fish in those caves, it kind of gave me a little more interest in the place, but it's a very unique park. But all of them are good. There's something good about all the parks. The park system, when I came aboard, the park system was run down pretty well. But now the Indiana state parks are one of the best in the nation. They run them right, just like all the divisions. When I came aboard, the law had game wardens, and they weren't too effective. But when Don Foltz became our first director of Department of Natural Resources, he changed all that. The law enforcement people, he changed all that. Now they're professional conservation officers, very talented, wonderful people. And it's so much different. The whole department is professional now. At one time, it wasn't. But I could see the changes coming up gradually. And it all started back when Don Foltz said, I knew Don Foltz. I knew him up at Purdue. And he said, I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican, but I want people who are qualified. From now on, we're going to have qualified people. And he's the guy that started us up to professionalism. And today, most of the parks are very, very good. And Fish and Wildlife Division, for the parks, hell, they're all run the way they should be run now. Indiana, we have a good system here. But I've seen it grow. I've seen it grow. From nothing up to a great organization. Like I said, we have a darn good state. Indiana's one of the best states in the union, not only because of academic, we have so many good schools, but we have good leaders, we have good people. And I don't know, I like Indiana. Of course, the reason I came back, I was going to school at Berkeley, California. Some professor talked me into coming back. And
we got you back.
And we're in the black too. We're not like a lot of states. We're in the red. Indiana is financially sound, and we want to keep it that way. And I think we can. We've had good governors, and we still got good governors, and I'm proud of them. That's the way I look at it. But I've been lucky all my life. I got a lot of people to thank to help me, and if I could continue with the luck that I've been having, I'll have a good retirement.
Bob, you really are an inspiration. Thank you for your service to Indiana, and thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, and whatever I told you, that's the way it is.
That interview originally aired on January 31st. Bob Vollmer retired last Thursday at age 102 from his job with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Find our podcast wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we'll learn about a bill making its way through the State House that would change the rules for kids on Medicaid who need inpatient mental health services. We'll talk with a reporter who's been covering the story, a lawmaker behind the bill, and a healthcare worker who faces the issue every day. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.